solid old building, nicely furnished, certainly luxurious for any student. 1,800 euros a month, 1 year's lease, utilities extra. Mr. Ilya did nothing but frown, as if his spoiled son would require something much nicer. The assistant frowned, too. They frowned all the way down the stairs into the car and said nothing as the driver hurried to the second stop. It was on Via Remosella, one block west of Via Fondazza. The flat was slightly larger than the first, had a kitchen the size of a broom closet, was badly furnished, had no view whatsoever, was 20 minutes away from the university, cost 2,600 euros a month, and even had a strange odor to it. The frowning stopped. They liked the place. "This will be fine," Mr. Ilya said, and Stefano breathed a sigh of relief. With a bit of luck, he wouldn't have to entertain them over lunch, and he'd just earned a nice commission. They hurried over to the office of Stefano's company, where paperwork was produced at a record pace. Mr. Ilya was a busy man with an urgent meeting in Rome, and if the rental couldn't be completed right then, on the spot, then forget everything. The black Mercedes sped them back to the airport, where a rattled and exhausted Stefano said thanks and farewell and hurried away as quickly as possible. Mr. Ilya and his assistant walked across the tarmac to his jet and disappeared inside. The door closed. The jet didn't move. Inside, Mr. Ilya and his assistant had ditched their business garb and were dressed casually. They huddled with three other members of their team. After waiting for about an hour, they finally left the jet, hauled their substantial baggage to the private terminal, then into waiting vans. Luigi had become suspicious of the navy blue Silvio bag. Marco never left it in his apartment. It was never out of his sight. He carried it everywhere, strapped over his shoulder and tucked tightly under his right arm as if it contained gold. What could he possibly possess now that required such protection? He rarely carried his study materials anywhere. If he and Ermanno studied inside, they did so in Marco's apartment. If they studied outside, it was all conversation and no books were used. Whitaker in Milano was suspicious too, especially since Marco had been spotted in an internet cafe near the university. He sent an agent named Crater to Bologna to help Zelman and Luigi keep a closer eye on Marco and his troublesome bag. With the noose tightening and fireworks expected, Whitaker was asking Langley for even more muscle on the streets. But Langley was in chaos. Teddy's departure, though certainly not unexpected, had turned the place upside down. The shock waves from Lucat's sacking were still being felt. The president was threatening a major overhaul, and the deputy directors and high-level administrators were spending more time protecting their butts than watching their operations. It was Crater who got the radio message from Luigi that Marco was drifting toward Piazza Maggiore, probably in search of his late afternoon coffee. Crater spotted him as he strode across the square, dark blue bag under his right arm, looking very much like a local. After studying a rather thick file on Joel Backman, it was nice to finally lay eyes on him. If the poor guy only knew. But Marco wasn't thirsty, not yet, anyway. He passed the cafes and shops, then suddenly, after a furtive glance, stepped into Albergo Nettuno, a 50-room boutique hotel just off the piazza. Crater radioed Zelman and Luigi, who was particularly puzzled because Marco had no reason whatsoever to be entering a hotel. Crater waited 5 minutes, then walked into the small lobby, absorbing everything he saw. To his right was a lobby area, with some chairs and a few travel magazines strewn over a wide coffee table. To his left was a small empty phone room, with its door open, then another room that was not empty. Marco sat there, alone, hunched over the small table under the wall-mounted phone, his blue bag open. He was too busy to see Crater walk by.
"May I help you, sir?" the clerk said from the front desk.
"Yes, thanks. I wanted to inquire about a room,"
Crater said in Italian.
For when?
Tonight.
I'm sorry, but we have no vacancies.
Crater picked up a brochure at the desk.
You're always full, he said with a smile. It's a popular place.
Yes, it is. Perhaps another time.
Do you by chance have internet access?
Of course.
Wireless?
Yes, the first hotel in the city. He backed away and said,
Thanks. I'll try again another time.
Yes, please. He passed the phone room on the way out. Marco had not looked up. With both thumbs, he was typing his text and hoping he would not be asked to leave by the clerk at the front desk. The wireless access was something the Nettuno advertised, but only for its guests. The coffee shops, libraries, and one of the bookstores offered it free to anyone who ventured in, but not the hotels. His email read, Grinch, I once dealt with a banker in Zurich name of Michael von Thyssen at Rhineland Bank on Bahnhofstrasse, downtown Zurich. See if you can determine if he's still there. If not, who took his place? Do not leave a trail. Marco. He pushed send and once again prayed that he had done things right. He quickly turned off the Onkyo 850 and tucked it away in his bag. As he left, he nodded at the clerk who was on the phone. 2 minutes after Crater came out of the hotel, Marco made his exit. They watched him from three different points, then followed him as he mixed easily with the late afternoon rush of people leaving work. Zelman circled back, entered the Nettuno, went to the second phone room on the left, and sat in the seat where Marco had been less than 20 minutes earlier. The clerk, puzzled now, pretended to be busy behind his desk. An hour later, they met in a bar and retraced his movements. The conclusion was obvious, but still hard to swallow. Since Marco had not used the phone, he was freeloading on the hotel's wireless internet access. There was no other reason to randomly enter the hotel lobby, sit in a phone room for less than 10 minutes, then abruptly leave. But how could he do it? He had no laptop, no cell phone other than the one Luigi had loaned him, an outdated device that would only work in the city and could in no way be upgraded to go online. Had he obtained some high-tech gadget? He had no money. Theft was a possibility. They kicked around various scenarios. Zelman left to email the disturbing news to Whitaker. Crater was dispatched to begin window shopping for an identical blue Silvio bag. Luigi was left to contemplate dinner. His thoughts were interrupted by a call from Marco himself. He was in his apartment, not feeling too well. His stomach had been jumpy all afternoon. He'd canceled his lesson with Francesca, and now he was begging off dinner. Chapter 24. If Dan Sandberg's phone rang before 6 a.m., the news was never good. He was a night owl, a nocturnal creature who often slept until it was time to have breakfast and lunch together. Everyone who knew him also knew that it was pointless to phone early. It was a colleague at the Post.
You got scooped, buddy, he announced gravely.
What? Sandberg snapped.
The Times just wiped your nose for you.
Who?
Backman.
What?
Go see for yourself.
Sandberg ran to the den of his messy apartment and attacked his desk computer. He found the story, written by Heath Frick, a hated rival at the New York Times. The front page headline read, FBI Pardon Probe Searches for Joel Backman. Citing a host of unnamed sources, Frick reported that the FBI's Cash for Pardon investigation had intensified and was expanding to include specific individuals who were granted reprieves by former President Arthur Morgan. Duke Mongo was named as a person of interest, a euphemism often tossed about when the authorities wanted to taint a person they were unable to formally indict. Mongo, though, was hospitalized and rumored to be gasping for his last breath. The probe was now focusing its attention on Joel Backman, whose 11th-hour pardon had shocked and outraged many, according to Frick's gratuitous analysis. Backman's